Mr. Teague's capabilities and proficiency were in his manner, in his bearing, in his ability to use words,
right,
to, and his ability to understand a potential client's problem, and at that meeting commit to generally to a price and come home and confirm it in a letter, and then transmit that information to the people on his staff. This is the problem. This is the resolution. This is how long you have to take to come up with a presentation of the resolution to the problem. And I'm going to go and then his salesmanship in making the presentation and convincing the people that this was the answer to a maiden's prayer, so to speak.
And often was.
And that he was excellent and proficient. But also his ability to put the idea on the table when he was talking to the staff.
I guess I was thinking of late 20s, early 30s, when you had compared to the later staff, the skeleton staff, but it is true from what Mr. Kibble said that you were encouraged to promote from within.
To
bring along a young designer like yourself and involve you in more and more important projects.
And
was that your experience with Mr. Kibble?
Yes, that was my experience.
How did you work?
The first time I ever met Mr. Teague was in 1938. I was sitting on the aisle down at 210 Madison Avenue, right across the way from Edward and his brother, who was sitting at desks on the other side of the aisle. He was trying to control his brother. Always trying to control his brother. But anyway, and Charlie Colby introduced me to Mr. Teague, and it was just as natural as can be. I mean, he didn't make me feel, he made me feel welcome. And within 3 or 4 days, he came down the aisle with a piece of paper about that big and a pencil in his hand like that. And he said, we have to design some hubcaps for a new car that's coming out, the Mercury that Ford is introducing at the 1938 World's Fair, and 1939 World's Fair, I guess that was the year, wasn't it? Anyway, and I want you to make me a few sketches of this. And it was, that's all. It didn't say anything on it. It just was like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I made a few sketches like that, and I went up this side, and up that side, and up that side, and down this side. And he had tons of drawings. one of them was produced. I can't remember which one now, but it was a spherical. At that time, it was a spherical device, and but that's the way. And after that, he used to come up to me with these little things, and I'd have to do these private little jobs that he had, along, of course, with assignments from Charlie Colby, who was the chief draftsman. I had assignments from Charlie Colby too.
Which Mr. Teague would not. But,
he didn't go through Charlie Colby.
Was there a few problems with that?
But that.
There's no problems.
And then in 1946, he he was out in California, and he had met Mr. Beale, gone to Seattle to meet Mr. Beale, and apparently they'd consummated an agreement.
Mr. Beale.
Of Boeing, B-E-A-L-L. And he came home, and he talked with Mr. Robert Harper, who was then the major partner in the organization and head of the design department. And apparently they decided, after asking a lot of other guys that whether they wanted to go to Seattle or not, they decided to say I was going. So he called me down to the office and said, "You're going to Seattle on Tuesday morning."
And this was like Friday afternoon.
Yes, this was a Friday afternoon.
You'd never been to Seattle?
I'd never been west of western border of New Jersey. High Point, New Jersey, as a matter of fact. And
you'd never been on an airplane?
Never been on an airplane. So Tuesday morning, it took 24 hours to fly to Seattle. We left at 7.
What type of aircraft did you?
DC-3.
DC-3.
And we stopped every 250 miles. And when we got to Chicago, well, I thought we were, at that time, remembering my grammar school geography as Chicago as being the center of the United States. I figured, well, it's not much further than this. And we got to some place in North Dakota, Bismarck, North Dakota. We still had another 1,100 and some odd miles to go.
What sort of accommodations did they have in those days? Did they have meals?
They had meals, and when they stopped at some of the airports, they fed you at the airport.
I see.
Also.
At the terminal.
So you had meals in the flight, mm-hmm. and meals at the terminals, and they were very, very nice.
Did water and coffee in the...
Oh, yes.
A bathroom.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Of sorts.
Of sorts. Rather primitive. Now, leading up to what I'm sure you're leading up to, how were the seats? How were they arranged? And were they almost as
primitive as they are today.
Really?
Because in that time they were a little more generous with the space than the airline is today. The airlines are destroying themselves with the way they're crowding people in, but that's another story.
We'll get to that eventually.
However,
were there two on each?
There was two on one side and one on the other.
Okay.
Three abreast, mm-hmm. and they were not exactly aligned across the airplane, if I remember correctly. They were slightly off alignment for reasons of galley and the service area in the back of the airplane.
Right.
Had something to do with that. And the ability to get into the cockpit up front.
Mm-hmm. There was a center aisle, of course.
Yes, mm-hmm. more or less.
Were there stewardesses?
Yes, they had a stewardess on board, one girl on board, and a pilot and a co-pilot.
That's it.
That was it.
So you finally got to Seattle after many stops.
Oh, yes. At 4:30 in the morning, which was 7:30 New York time. So it took 24 hours in a snowstorm.
Oh, no.
With Bob Harper. Bob Harper was with me. He had, matter of fact, took me out there.
Was he the project's manager?
No, he was a partner.
Maybe he was the Tick senior partner.
I see.
And he we reported to the Boeing company the next day, and we were installed in with their engineering group to work on the interiors of the Stratocruisers, and we were waiting for four other members of the five-man team that were assigned to Seattle.
The Stratocruiser was Boeing's first post-war
commercial airplane. Yes.
Was it a redevelopment of any of their wartime airplanes?
Well, it. No, they didn't have a. They didn't have a double lobe wartime airplane. It was a. It probably had some. A lot of B-29. In it. But it wasn't really all B-29 parts. It had a lot of it in it. But by the time you redevelop an airplane, you end up doing a lot of so many new things that it's really a new airplane.
What was your mandate from Mr. T? What was your primary purpose for this? Or to Boeing?
He didn't really tell me what he wanted at Boeing. I think he told Bob what he wanted at Boeing. The inference was to support the effort that Boeing was doing, make a major contribution wherever we could to the interior of the airplane as it had been developed by them. And then to support the development of the seats, and to support that was a soft fabric interior, to support the inspection processes of the colors and other aspects of other decorative aspects of the program, some of which was split off and sent back here for inspection purposes, because a lot of the material was woven and dyed back in North Carolina. I think it was North. No, it was up in Goodall, up in Connecticut, and North Carolina. Both. They were just moving a lot of the mills down at the time.
The industry didn't
anyhow.
Stop.
But I knew what the mandate was: keep your head down and your butt up and produce. That was the mandate, and see that everybody else on the team did the same thing and maintain the decorum and the image of all the volunteer associates.
Then I take it Mr. Harper would be the consultant of record at the moment. He would consult with the Boeing officials as to what.
No, he didn't. I was doing all that.
Good.
He came home.
Oh, he left. Oh, he left.
Yeah,
you there.
He left me there. And he was there 4 days and left me there in charge of our destiny.
The interior work of airplanes up to this time hadn't been really. It'd been sort of a left-handed kind of operation.
Well, interior work up to that time were doped interiors, doped fabrics, which was nothing more than a lacquer, and most of it was either gray or mauve, or values of gray and mauve combined, and the seats were Bedford cord or something of that nature, all wool, because it was as non-flammable a material as they could find, but the dope fabric was deadly. However, they went on to the Stratocruiser, which had an entirely different philosophy. That was a totally soft interior, because they were using the fabric for sound absorption purposes. And it was a lightweight 7-ounce wool weaving. And there was the ability to get a little bit more color into the airplanes.
I had the impression Mr. Teague was a master colorist.
He had a great, he He had a great sense of color, but he loved blue.
Ah, okay.
Can I put it that way? But he did have a great sense of color. But he said, I have a corner on blue, Dreyfus has a corner on beige and brown, and we're not concerned about what Louis had, what corner Louis is working.
So your mandate was to make it more comfortable, make it brighter, make it cheerier, and make it safer.
Yeah.
And then to expand on the then, I suspect, then infant concept of ergonomics or ergometrics.
Yes, which was really just about starting. What's the name of there was a fellow at Yale, doctor, something like that. Anthropometric professor of anthropometrics up at Yale, and I can't remember his name now. At the time, he reminded me a little bit of the movie director, the round English movie director who's now dead.
Hitchcock.
Yeah, Hitchcock.
We can insert it later if you send me the name.
Well, if I remember it, I'd be glad to say it. But
and some of his articles and become.
Yeah, and then there was a man by the name of MacArthur who had written a couple of books on related specifically or geared specifically toward airplane seating. MacArthur. I have those two books. I don't know where they are. Anyhow. But that was the mandate. You perform and do. He didn't get too specific. I mean, he would come out twice a year just to see how things were going and to relate to Mr. Beale and Mr. Wells. And I would bring him through, take him through the plant and show him what we were doing. Develop work statements for follow-on work, and we were hired for 3 months, and then we were renewed for an additional 3 months, and then we were renewed for 6 months, and 6 months, and then for a year, and then for 2 years, and 2 years, and 2 years, and then finally for 5 years, and in 5 year contract with Boeing.
Early 50s.
But it was after the markup.
Yeah, it was after the markup.
The 5 year contract, I believe, started in 1958, 57, 58, something like that.
When was the Stratocruiser introduced? Do you remember?
In 1948 or 49.
It was the first.
48.
First new, relatively all new. Passenger airplane.
Yes, it and the DC-6 were kind of out of the barn like that, DC-6 and Stratocruiser. But Boeing Company didn't sell enough Stratocruisers to make it profitable, so they decided to get out of the commercial business.
What year was that?
By 1950 they had delivered all. I believe they had delivered all the airplanes by 1950.
Uh-huh.
There were only 25 of them to five customers, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's 19 50, 51 at the outside. And they went on to produce the B-47s and the B-52s.
Did you stay on for the military? And
oh, yes.
Oh,
we were on continuously. We have been there continuously since 1946. I believe it's the longest single client consultant relationship in the history of the Boeing Company, but I think I wouldn't be surprised if it might not be in the history of the industrial design profession.
That's incredible. And you've done all their commercial and later military work.
Yes.
Interior
work.
Yes. It's increasingly technical, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, we don't do their military work anymore. But we did work on the B-50. On the B-47 and the B-52, mm-hmm. and they were on what we called at the time habitability,
uh-huh.
which is has now been expanded to human engineering, but basically habitability and ways and means of getting things more comfortable for the people that have to sit in those cramped quarters.
Yeah.
And found that if a man could move his legs, he could relieve a hell of a lot of muscles and improve his comfort level. So we're always trying to get stuff off the floor, mm-hmm. off the deck. And he was very interested in that kind of stuff. And from there, we then got involved and they began a building program out there, and we got involved in designing the buildings, doing the initial layout of the site planning and the buildings proper, and then finally doing the interiors. But we were not the architects of record. The architects of record are people like Leo Daly and the Austin Company, and John Maloney of Seattle, and one or two other people. But we had a great deal to do with the development of the image of the Boeing Company in terms of plant visuals. We did the interiors of all their cafeterias, and we used to do a lot of their technical brochures and technical exhibits, and anything you could. It was a real good industrial design cross section of graphics, architecture, interiors, product, and it was fantastic. It was just a fantastic thing. We never really took advantage of it. Never really took advantage of it. And I never knew why, but that was the way he was.
What do you think the reason for this long-term satisfaction, which seemed to be unprecedented in industrial design history?
What do I think the reason is?
Yeah. That the Boeing Company kept you on.
Well, I don't know. They sold about how many billions of dollars worth of products. That must have something to do with it. Although the airplanes are obviously technically perfect, but we've contributed to making them that much better. The other thing that we did initially in the initial 707 was to develop an interior that had great decorative potential. That was the primary objective. Make an airplane that had great decorative potential so that whatever the airlines wanted to do with it inside could be done with it within certain parameters, cost parameters,
mm-hmm.
that we, Boeing, had developed.
This idea of a residential, an in-house, I mean a consultant in residence became increasingly important in the scheme of the company plans in terms of image and decoration, and this seemed to me to be almost quite unusual for that period.
Well, the company is pretty big, and they seem very sure that they get more out of dealing with an organization like ours than they do if they had an in-house design group, because an in-house, they don't know how to handle for as long as we've been there, they don't know, I don't believe they know how to handle an industrial designer of their, within their own framework of their own operation, because they're all engineers, and it's a matter of mutual respect, and it's a matter of performance, and it's a matter of having the courage to stand up and tell them. Sometime, one of these days, we'll have them get cut off at the pockets, but having the courage to tell them if they're wrong when they're wrong. But also having the capability to help them solve the problem, to make it more right than it would have been. Maybe not as right as we would like, our egos would like it to be, but more right than it would have been.
As resident designer and project manager, were you able to convince the company that they should go in this direction or that direction, or should adopt this design scheme?
Yes.
They were amenable to that. How big of a staff did you have?
Well, we've been as high as, we now have, I think, 56 people out there. We've been as high as 90, if I'm not wrong. 98 people, I think, we had out in Seattle one time. When I was traveling back, when I was commuting back and forth, we had about 90 people out there.
A number of people were
all on the board and supervised, etc.
Seat design is certainly a major problem for the automobile industry. I guess it's always been for the aircraft industry, isn't it? Have there been any major breakthroughs in seat design?
Well, we have just happened to have our back pocket. We work for the Jepson Burns Seat Company, formerly
Fairchild Burns
Seat Company.
B-U-R-N-S.
Yes, and they're in North Carolina. The present name is Jepson Burns.
J-E-P-S-O-N.
Yes, and we designed an aircraft seat that was fairly comfortable for what it had to do, and fairly comfortable for the manufacturing process that it went through, and it was supposed to be spaced at 32 inches, I think. But that's because the airlines are asking the seat manufacturers to get to the post office, to get to that kind of geometric relationship. And we find ways of doing it, but in the end, it's not the right thing to do to passengers. yes, we're in the seat business, and we've designed comfortable seats. And Mr. Teague was always one of involved in seating office furniture for Senego and the early seats for the Stratocruiser and the early seats for the 707, the ones I did for the department. He was very interested in what was going on and wanted to.
Kibble, may I ask you, you were a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. How did that come about?
Well, I enlisted.
I know, but I mean, what particular talents did you use in the Air Force to rise to that rather lofty eminence?
Well, when I went into the Air Force, I went in as an enlisted man. I had graduated from college. And after about 2 or 3 weeks after my basic training, they sent me to school in Sacramento, and I came out and joined a small observation squadron that was connected to the 2nd Armored Division, which was General Patton's group. Within 19 months, they offered me a direct commission. I turned it down because I didn't feel I had the knowledge to be an officer. And they decided to send me to Officer Kennedy School in Miami, which had just started. Mm-hmm. And I went down and took that 90 days, as they call, used to call us 90-day wonders.
Right. Mm-hmm.
When I came out, I was sent to back to Sacramento, where I went to school, and engineering school, and I was then assigned to a rather large bomb group, the 100th Bomb Group, that was somewhere in the United States, because they kept sending me places and I couldn't catch up with it, because we had traveled by train. By the time I got to the location on the orders, they had moved. I finally caught up with them in Pueblo, Colorado, and I was with them until they went overseas. But before that, I had been assigned to the British to outside of London and to study their problems. Then I went to with the Canadians for a while to try to understand their problems.
What did you become a specialist in? Ordnance?
No, in the aircraft. Aircraft maintenance, and I became the engineering for that group called the service group, and we were responsible for such things as engine build-ups, and I was responsible for all the shops that did the repair work. I did that for about 2 years, and then I was assigned to S2, which is the security end of the, and I performed duties with them, and I can't talk about that.
It's still classified, huh?
It is still classified, yes. I was, I went on missions. I was behind the lines quite for some time. And then I I was assigned, went to Africa, and tried to work deals out with the groups in Africa, not to support the Germans.
Previous to Overlord, was it? No. What was the African invasion?
I don't know which one you're talking about. We had a
North African,
yes. That was the time of Rommel's running all over Africa.
Right.
And I came back to England, joined the 100 Bomb Group in time for the for D-Day, the invasion of Europe. And I stayed with the 100th Bomb Group then until the the end of that. I flew some missions.
Mm-hmm.
And,
what airplane?
B-17.
Those were fraught with dangers.
Well, we first went over the, they had no modification kits. We were losing ships. Our tail gunners were being killed, and they were shooting up the airplane from underneath. I worked with them on the modification kits for the pilots' protection. Then I took over the what they call then the Air Corps Supply, responsible for maintaining all the hundreds of items that we needed to repair.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out on the lines to, after the air, the planes came back to work with the engineering groups from the various aircraft on the damages. I sat in on the interrogation and on the briefings before and after they come back. I sat on the briefings and then they come back. And when the war ended, I had planned on, as I say, going back into the Air Force and going to Germany and the Army of Occupation, but Mr. Teague talked me out of it.
He must have been very eloquent because the Air Force must have been very exciting for him.
It was, yes.
The thought of coming back to an office and the somewhat prosaic world of industrial design.
Well, I found that it was very difficult for me to sit in a seat at a desk.
You mean after the Air Force?
Yes. Yes.
It seemed to me that that also you probably were very often very uncomfortable in the airplane as such. They never paid much attention to the comfort of the pilots or the gunners in those days.
No, we lost quite a few airplanes because of the... Well, the airplane, the B-17, was never meant to be a bomber airplane. America was caught at the beginning of the war with no suitable airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the B-17 was slated to be a commercial airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And they had no others, and they started to build them. And of course, as they modified them, they became known as the Flying Fortress. But they weren't that in the beginning.
So, Mr. Teague enticed you back to the Walter Garden Diggers Ocean.
That's right, yes. I came back for a Christmas party in uniform. And he said to me, of course you're not going to stay in the services, you'll come back here. And before I knew it, he was a very persuasive man. I was hanging up my uniform and coming back.
What was your title?
I was assigned then, what he wanted me to do was to go through the various parts of the organization, which I did. I went to accounting, then I went into, I became the office manager, then I became assistant controller, and then I became the controller and director of personnel. And in 1967, when the company became incorporated, I became a vice president and secretary of the organization and chief administrative and financial officer of the company. In 1979 or 80, Frank promoted me to senior, I'm the executive vice president.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1981 or 82, I became president of the company and chief operating officer.
So in large part, your post-war career was taken up with the internal financial and personnel and internal structure of the organization.
That's right, yeah.
What sort of problems did you have at the outset of the post-war period? There were probably some personnel problems, people returning from the service.
Yes, quite a few, in fact.
Wanting their old jobs back, or hoping to get their old jobs back.
We didn't have too much of that, very frankly. The organization had a pretty strong group that had worked during the war.
You did essential war work, so perhaps some could have been deferred.
They were deferred, yes. But we didn't have too many come back.
Uh-huh.
To work, because we were a very small organization all during, before the war and then during the war. And at 19...
what was the average number of employees?
I guess we had about 25 or 30.
Pre-war?
Yes.
And after the war, you began to expand?
Oh, yes, quite a bit. And we had what I call bunching of major assignments. In the 50s, we had the Air Force Academy, the 707, all at, and later on, in the later part of the 50s, we had the 747 airplane. That was about the beginning of the 50s.
747. That was in 1965, I think.
Yes, and we had a tremendous job getting people to, into the organization, because we didn't have the skills. The skills weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to train a lot of our people to do the job. And also the fact that we had moved a lot of that work out to the West Coast to Seattle.
Because of the Boeing company.
Yeah. And a lot of people didn't want to leave the areas where they felt only design, where there was only design, such as New York and Chicago. They didn't want to go out to the West Coast, because there's nothing there for them if something happened, if they were released. There's no jobs for them out there. And they didn't, the risk was great. But as we begin to get the very interesting projects that Frank worked on, it became not quite as difficult to get people to go out. Also, the one thing that we did, we had here is, again, is the feeling that if you went to work with Walter Dornteig Associates, that we had sort of leveled out the highs and the lows,
mm-hmm.
so that they could feel security when they came to work with us. One of the things we wanted to do was build a strong team, and we had to come up with ways of holding that team together. And I think we're one of the few organizations that has a pension plan. A lot of them don't have that in the industrial design field.
How many years have you had that?
Since the middle 70s.
Was it retroactive in any way?
No, it really wasn't. What we finally did went back to the beginning of the corporation to give some of our people who had been with us for a number of years. But the pension plan is a very good one.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have a tremendous medical program, which we pay, the firm pays 90% of it.
This is unusual in the design field.
Yes, it's a major medical. It's also dental. And if you stay with Walter Dornteig Associates until you retire, not normal retirement age is 65, you and your wife are protected for the rest of your life by a major medical program.
This is not growth of Mr. Teague's philosophy, do you think?
No.
I wanted to ask you about the salary levels in the 30s and 40s. How would they compare with the other comparable design firms those years?
Oh, we paid the same.
Did you?
Yes, we matched it. But at that time, the attitude, I think, of most entrepreneurial types were that there was no need to give them all these benefits. Mr. Teague had a philosophy that if you were a professional, you took care of these things yourself. I think that might have that attitude. Wasn't that his attitude? You took care of it yourself.
Uh-huh.
And there's still a lot of firms that believe that.
Believe that.
Yeah, very strongly, in fact. But we felt that what we wanted to do was to relieve the designer of that kind of a worry, and where he could be more creative and not worry about it.
In terms of projects, certainly the end of World War II must have let loose an explosion of needs in the industrial design field. Was the firm pretty much in the forefront of capturing those needs and coming up with new products?
Yes, we were.
What type of type of...
Well, if you want to take the years of 1944 and 1945, and let's take 1945, we had the Bakelite Corporation, we had E.W. Budd.
What were you doing? Do you remember the products that were done for those organizations?
Well, we're designing offices for the Bakelite.
Did you get pretty much in, did you become an interior a specialist in those years as well?
Well, yes, we did quite a bit of...
I mean, you expanded on your interior orientation in the 30s, and you began to design whole office buildings and whole complexes by then, did you not?
Well, we did. I know the offices for the Carrier Corporation at that time. We were involved in work for the offices in the 40s for the Bakelite, as I stated before.
The large plastic firm.
Yes, that's what, yes. And we did a lot of designing of plants and buildings for the Ford Company. And during that period of time, we did lobby displays and some lobby designs for the Ream Manufacturing Company. We also then did a restudy of the service stations for the Texaco Company about that time.
Yes. What year was that?
That was 1945.
This was a major breakthrough too, was it not? In terms of service station design.
Just right, yes. That was a redesign study now.
You're right.
Not
your original one.
Yes. We did, for American Present Line, we did surveys of their office, ticket office sites. We did, we did work for the lock company, the SCHALE lock company. In fact, Slade, a lock company. In 1946, we did the design of the passenger offices in New York for the American President line. We also did some product design for the Linden Air Products Company. We did a model of the steel mill for the trademark for American Industry Incorporated. We did the radio, we did some radio work, radio station work, and radio studio work for a company called Finch Telecommunications.
This was an area which had been rather in the dark ages, also. Right. Needed to come out.
We did work for General Mills and a museum. We did offices and showrooms, conference rooms, furniture, and decorative maps for the Ford Company.
So, largely in the post-war years, you became a continued your emphasis on interiors pretty much and expanded that.
Yes, that's right.
When did you begin to move outside the interior? Was there a period when someone said, look, we're pretty much number one in interior work, close to it. Are we going to expand outside the office, outside the interior complex? Was there ever a thought along those lines?
Outside to become in terms of the facade of the building,
right? Exactly. Oh. Yeah, or perhaps the consultants in the overall arrangement of a complex of buildings.
Well, that I think that happened in two places, in two separate at two separate times, I should say. We started to, we did a city planning job for a town in New Jersey.
Montclair, New Jersey.
And Tonawanda.
Tonawanda.
No, that was the second job.
Montclair.
Montclair. That's right. And these were done while I was out in Seattle, so I really talking out of my place, but and almost while that job was becoming completed, They did a city planning job for the Tonawandas up in New York State, up around the Buffalo area. Because that's one of the things that captured Mr. Teague's fancy. He wanted desperately to do something in that scope, that kind of a job. And he was dickering with Boston. Well, I was still here when he was dickering with Boston.
Yeah.
That was 1944, I guess.
When you say city planning, what did that entail?
Eddie can fill you in on that because I'm not familiar. I only know about the time scale of that.
That's fascinating. How did that evolve, the concept of being a city planner?
Well, I think at that time a lot of cities were talking about it, and a lot of schools. I think Yale had to put in a city planning seat up there. And I think Mr. Tibby became fascinated with the problems of city living.
Right.
In fact, I remember one time being in a meeting when he talked about it, and he felt that the cities could be straightened up. Mm-hmm. He felt they were in trouble, mm-hmm. and they were getting into trouble. And I know that he approached Boston. I don't know how far he got with that. I wasn't
not very
far. But it fascinated him, and he talked about getting a group together to solve some of the problems of living within the city. He thought of areas that industry could be, living quarters could be, schools should be, transportation. He was always appalled by the maze of one-way streets and avenues, and he thought they could all be cleaned up. And I think at one time he dreamed that somewhere we could design a city.
That I think that was expressed in the San Francisco, and not in the San Fran. That was in the steel building at the United States.
That's right.
In the U.S. Steel Pavilion at the 1938-39 World's Fair. I think that's where he really got the bug.
Creating
bug
a
bit him.
A modern city, yes.
Yeah.
In fact, I think if you were to read parts of his Design This Day, he talks about that quite a bit, this, I hate to use the word, perfect city, but I think that's what he was talking about.
He was appalled by the conditions he saw around.
That's right. Also, we, many years ago, Mr. Teague designed a house that could be built. And it was he did that for the Adirondack people, and that was right after World War II.
Low-cost house?
Yes, it was. And it was what we call the Teague Look House. Look being the magazine.
Oh, I see.
And but Mr. Teague designed a house that could be put together in a very short period of time, because at that time, right after the war, as you remember, and we were coming back from service, we had no place to live. And Mr. Teague was very interested, and he did develop a house that could be manufactured and then brought back into a site and just put together.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the Lincoln log sites we had as kids?
Right.
Well, that was building a house. In sections, some of those were sections. I think you have something
on it. Something in here about it on some.
It's kind of he was always interested in prefabricated houses,
mm-hmm.
for housing the masses of humanity in the United States.
So
I guess that was probably brought on by what they called the Hoover Village and Sea Caucus
and Levittown.
The unfortunate thing brought on by the Depression, the homeless, and all of the farms being the Dust Bowl condition, and all of that. It was relatively leaned quite. quite strongly toward humanitarian programs,
yeah.
But it was not without a price. I mean, it was not without his benefits to himself coming out of it.
They're almost public service projects.
Yes. The market was there. He beginnings of market man responding to the market before they even had BMAs, MBAs. I mean, I always get those damn initials mixed up. But he was very astute at that.
Mm-hmm.
Observation of the requirements out there, his ability to respond to them.
I remember a conversation he had with me after I came back from the service. And he found out because there wasn't any place for me to really live except with my folks or with my wife's folks.
Mm-hmm.
And he was appalled by that. And it was, I think, in 1947. Then I told him about the houses that Bill Levitt were doing out on Long Island.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. And I told him that I had put in my application for one of those houses. And it was very early, before most people knew about that Levittown, or even before Levittown was proposed by Bill Levitt himself and his father. But anyhow, Saturday morning, after I had moved in and was settled there, Mr. Teague showed up at my door. That was such an unusual thing for Mr. Tick to do. I was, when I came to the door and saw him there, I almost fell down because that was not the way he did things. And he said he had been out in that area, knew that I lived there, had looked my phone number up and address and thought he'd pay a visit. And he went through the house.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty near a prefab house.
Mm-hmm.
As close as you could get to it at that time without getting into union problems.
What was his professional reaction?
He did not like the idea of both the Levittown, although the exterior of the houses was quite different. He didn't like the rows. He was not as critical of the Levitt organizations, I thought he may be, because they did have winding streets, they did have cul-de-sacs, they did have and he thought that was pretty good. But he did felt that it could become boring,
yeah.
Terribly boring, and he hoped that America wasn't going that way. But he was complimentary, I'd say, of good men.
Did he then think that the firm could design a better prefabricated?
Oh, definitely.
Yes, here's a section in here that
can you describe
we
it
can run copies
in audio terms. What sort of principle evolved from the...
It was a modular principle.
Okay.
Based on a mechanical joint.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-wired and
pre-cast.
Stressed.
Pre-stressed.
To the floor.
Yeah.
And with the... what I'm looking at here appears to have a flat roof,
mm-hmm.
which was not necessarily a popular type of, or relatively acceptable in the marketplace at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The Look House, of course, was designed in a way as to give it a Cape Cod character,
mm-hmm.
where they were very popular back here at the time, this was part of the commercialization of the product, so to speak. What I'm looking at is a prefabricated bathroom, kitchen wall, plus two bedrooms, a dining, living room, entranceway, and with a garage attached. More as opposed to the kind of thing you might get in Queens with the narrow two-story vertical hip roof house.
Would you say that his vision of post-war housing was another pioneering design?
I would in this respect, in that it had factory built capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And they are building factory built houses today that they move around on trailers. They build a half a house with the roof running in one direction, the other half a house on another trailer with the roof running in the other direction, and then they move it onto the site and somebody nails up the up the two sides of the roofs and hope that it stays level for the rest of its